Howell usually was an astute judge of Washington politics, but in the fall of 2001, his judgment seemed off. He no longer had the upper hand, but he didn't seem to recognize it, at least in his public comments. "Iraq isn't going anywhere," he told Bill Keller of the New York Times in his trademark "everybody calm down" mode. "It's in a fairly weakened state. It's doing some things we don't like. We'll continue to contain it." But the tide already was shifting. By seeming to catch the intelligence community asleep, the 9/11 attacks had created a new opportunity for those arguing that the professional intelligence analysts were underestimating the threat presented by Iraq, and especially the likelihood of it possessing chemical or biological weapons, or its willingness to share them with anti-American terrorists. "If you missed the warning signs on 9/11, the argument went at the time, what else are you missing now about Iraq? The new doubts about intelligence, along with the caution of top military officers, combined to deeply frustrate Rumsfeld, recalled one covert operations specialist who worked for the defense secretary during this period. "What I saw from 9/11 forward was Don Rumsfeld's shock and disillusion with intelligence. He had been working for decades with an intelligence community that was focused on one question, the Soviet order of battle. But when the intelligence community had to move down the scale to low-intensity conflict, well," his voice trailed off in the quiet disapproval of the disappointed professional. The first shock was on September 25, 2001, when Rumsfeld met with Charlie Holland, the Air Force general who then headed the U.S. Special Operations Command, which had been thrust into the limelight as one of the military commands most needed in response to Al-Qaeda's attack. Holland laid out a bunch of targets, including a terrorist training camp in Northwest Africa, an arms shipment point on the Somali coast, and a camp in the Philippines. Rumsfeld's mouth was watering. "When do we go?" And Holland said, "Well, we can't because we lack actionable intelligence." Rumsfeld was perturbed by that phrase and seized on it. "What is actionable intelligence?" the defense secretary began asking. "Is there such a type of intelligence that is inactionable?" In the following weeks, Rumsfeld would take steps to substantially increase the role his office played in gathering and analyzing intelligence. Formal Pentagon consideration of how to attack Iraq began in November 2001, just after the fall of Kabul. From the outset, there was tension between the uniformed military and the Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, over two related issues: whether to attack Iraq, and if so, how many troops to use. Caught between the Army's caution and Rumsfeld's impatience was the Central Command, commanded by General Tommy Franks. Officials who served in that headquarters offer conflicting accounts of the role it played in the debate over the war plan, but there is general agreement that Franks became the fulcrum in the planning for the war. He could go either way. He was a career Army officer, but with the passage of time, he sided with the Rumsfeld view. Franks was a cunning man, but not a deep thinker. He ran an extremely unhappy headquarters. He tended to berate subordinates, frequently shouting and cursing at them. Morale was poor, and people were tired, having worked nonstop since 9/11. It wasn't just a matter of low spirits among staffers, one officer added. Frank's abusive style tended to distort the information that flowed upward to him. "I am convinced that much of the information that came out of Central Command is unreliable because he demands it instantly. So people pull it out of their hats. It's all swags. Scientific wild-ass guesses. Also, everything has to be good news stuff. You would find out you can't tell the truth." Many senior Army staff officers had worked at CENTCOM during the 1990s, and so were familiar with the series of war plans refined there during that decade. Others had rotated through Kuwait. As a group, they were comfortable with the work that Zinni had left behind, calling for a big invasion force of about 350,000 troops. But the world had changed, argued Air Force Major General Victor Renwart, who held the key job of Director of Operations for the Central Command. There was no longer a need for an invasion force of that size. "We had many more precision weapons," said the veteran pilot who had commanded a fighter squadron in the 1991 Gulf War and later led units in both the northern and southern no-fly zones. We'd been flying over Iraq for 12 years and had substantially degraded their air defenses. We had good intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, and so good situational awareness of their ground forces. The conclusions of Desert Crossing, Zinni's post-Desert Fox study, were taken into consideration, but weren't a shaping factor, Renwart said. That plan envisioned attacking Iraq with three heavy armored divisions. It wasn't discarded, it just didn't fit the planning constraints we were given, he said. Among those constraints were to make the force smaller and faster than either the 1991 invasion force or Zinni's Desert Crossing force package. Ultimately, General Franks would employ a plan that used just one heavy division to spearhead the attack, backed by the helicopter-rich 101st Airborne, as well as lighter elements, part of the 82nd Airborne and some Marine and British units. Zinni said he heard a rather different account of why his plan was discarded late in 2002, which essentially was that Rumsfeld and his aides simply vetoed his work. When the military guys, the joint staff, officers working on the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, brought it up, the civilian leadership said, "No, its assumptions are too pessimistic," he said.